The 100 Years' War to the Giscolin period, the collapse of the English position on the continent. By New Year's Day of 1373, all prospect of help from England had disappeared. On that day, the magnates of Poitou made their conditional surrender to the Duke of Berry. Edward III's flagship, the Grace Dieu, reached Winchelsea, a progress of barely 50 miles after 2 weeks of beating into the wind. 9 months after they had been presented to the Great Council in Westminster, the King's ambitious plans for the year had come to nothing. More than £60,000 had been spent on the fleet and the armies of invasion, but not a single company of men had left England apart from the companions of the Earl of Pembroke and some minor reinforcements for the garrison of Calais. It was getting late in the season. The requisitioned merchantmen, which provided the bulk of Edward III's transports, were urgently required for the annual wine fleet to Bordeaux. The king would probably have had a mutiny on his hands if he had not released them. Most of the ships and the men serving in them were paid off on October the 6th. Edward himself refused to give up. He insisted the campaign was not over and declared that he expected to be at sea for another 3 weeks. It was not until October the 14th that he agreed to disembark from the Grace Dieu after 7 weeks on board. The prince recognized defeat earlier than his father. On October the 5th, he came before a packed meeting of the council at Westminster, bearing charters investing him with the Principality of Aquitaine. He declared to the assembled prelates, peers, and royal officials that he was resigning all of his continental titles and possessions into Edward's hands. One of the council, Guy Bryan, a respected veteran of Edward's wars, whose service dated back to the Scottish campaigns of the 1330s, asked the prince whether he really had his wish. The prince replied that it was. Less than a fifth of the great territory which he ruled in 1364 now remained under English control. England's only continental allies, Brittany and Portugal, were swiftly engulfed into disaster. On October the 16th, 1372, 6 months late, Neville finally sailed from Southampton with the wine fleet, escorted by ships of war of England and Bayonne. He landed at St. Matthew on the western tip of Finster, just with under 1,000 men. From here he swiftly took possession of Brest and a number of other walled places of the far west. A well-trained force even of this modest size might have made a great difference to John de Montfort's fortunes in the summer. But in October, it was too late. Beauchereau had surrendered. In vain, John de Montfort pleaded with the besiegers to take possession of it in his name. They claimed it for the King of France. The news of Neville's arrival completed the destruction of the Duke's cause. There was uproar amongst the prelates and leading noblemen of Brittany when they heard about it. The French king moved swiftly to exploit their anger. He had a large army at his disposal in the northwest Poitou, which was waiting for December the 1st, the date appointed for the surrender of Thars. On October the 22nd, 1372, these forces were diverted north. On the 28th, the Constable, the Dukes of Berry, Burgundy, and Bourbon, and Marshal Louis de Sancerre invaded Brittany. On the 30th, they were before Rennes. Their suspicions about John de Montfort were soon confirmed. The march had been so swift that John's English Duchess, who was in Rennes when their approach was reported, only just fled in time. She was caught a few miles south of the city on the road to Vannes by soldiers of the Duc de Bourbon. Many years later, when he was an old man, the Duc de Bourbon's standard-bearer recalled that her baggage was searched and they found the copy of her husband's treaty with Edward III, which Neville had brought with him from England. "Am I a prisoner?" the Duchess asked the Duc of Bourbon when she was brought before him. "No, madame," he replied, "we do not make war against women." But her husband, he added before releasing her, was playing a foolish game from which he could not easily extricate himself. He tried, John de Montfort certainly tried to extricate himself, but as the Duke of Bourbon had foreseen, it just wasn't easy. He wrote to the King of France admitting that he invited the English in, but saying that he had done it only in order to maintain his authority against Olivier de Clisson and other rebellious barons. He entered in direct negotiations with the leaders of the French army outside Rennes, protesting his good faith. A compromise was eventually patched up under which John agreed that he would expel the foreigners from his duchy, and the French agreed to withdraw their army from Rennes. But he never intended to honor it. Instead, he made his way to his fortress at Brest, where he met Neville and his officers, and secretly ratified the treaty with Edward III. Charles V's emissary, Guillaume Mauvenet, who came before the Duke to deliver the King's protest against his treachery, was treated to a charade in which John called the English captains before him and ordered them to depart. The only reason he explained why they were slow in complying was that ships could not be found to carry them back to England. In fact, John did nothing to expel Neville's men, and according to reports reading Paris, had even appealed to Edward III to send more. The French made the most of their discovery of John's secret diplomacy. The text of the Anglo-Breton Treaty was widely distributed in Brittany and provided mass desertions amongst the Breton nobility. Several of them swore never to serve him again. By the end of the year, John de Montfort's administration was still effective in Finistère around Venise and in Girondin Peninsula west of Nantes, but almost nowhere else. Neville succeeded in occupying a handful of ducal castles in the extreme west, but his garrisons were confined there by a wall of local hostility. Fernando of Portugal suffered his own nemesis shortly afterwards. He may not have known about the Battle of La Rochelle when he sealed the Treaty of Braga with John of Gaunt's emissaries in July, but he does not seem to have been shaken by the news of the battle, which must have reached him shortly afterwards, nor by the succession of reverses which the English suffered in southwestern France in August and September, not even by the growing signs of unrest in his own kingdom. His marriage and large-scale changes of personnel at the court which had followed it remained profoundly unpopular with the Portuguese nobility. His aggressive foreign policy was equally unwelcome to the mercantile oligarchies of the towns. Diego Pacheco reported to Henry of Trastamara on his mission to Portugal at Zamora about the end of August 1372. He advised an immediate invasion of Portugal. Don Fernando was too weak at home to put up any serious resistance. He thought this affection was so strong in Lisbon that a fifth column in the Portuguese capital might rise up at Henry's approach and deliver it to him. Pacheco's advice provoked rigorous debate in the Castilian king's council. Ultimately, Henry resolved to advance into Portugal. He had the same exaggerated view of England's capacity to launch an army across 1,000 miles of ocean as Fernando did, and was determined to snuff out the Anglo-Portuguese alliance before the English arrived. At the end of November 1372, Fernando began to realize the seriousness of his position. Juan Fernando Aldeiro, who was still in the Portuguese court, was sent back urgently to England for help. In about the middle of December 1372, Henry of Trastamara crossed the frontier west of Ciudad Rodrigo with a mixed army of Castilian vassals and French mercenaries. Pacheco's assessment of the country's defenses proved to be correct. The French and Castilians swept aside resistance around the frontier fortress of Alameda, capturing the city of Vesu and turning south. A second Castilian army, largely recruited at Andalusia and commanded by the masters of the military orders of Santiago and Calatrava, entered Portugal at the same time by the Tagus Valley at Alcantara. The two wings joined forces at Coimbra at the end of the year and prepared to advance on Lisbon. In Seville, where the Castilian fleet was being refitted and resupplied after the exertions of the summer, 12 galleys were being ready to attack the Portuguese capital from the sea. Fernando stood by hopelessly. In Poitou, the end had come. In the last days of November 1372, the French army began to gather outside the walls of Thours. Inside the fortress, the leaders of the local nobility were waiting for December the 1st, the day appointed for them to submit to the crown of France unless Edward III or the Black Prince got through to them with a relief force. The abandonment of Edward III's seaborne expedition was known in the principality by now. In Bordeaux, Sir Thomas Felton was desperately trying to assemble a relief force from the shrunken remnant of the principality still under his control. He succeeded in raising a small scratch army from local nobility of the Bordelais in southern Perigord. With only a short time to go before the deadline, Felton marched north to Niort. There he found the remaining English captains waiting for him, Sir Diggory Say, Sir John Devereux, and Sir John Cresswell. They had a handful of Poitvin loyalists with them. Total strength of the English and their allies was about 1,200 men-at-arms. Felton and his colleagues sent a herald forward to the Poitvins in Thours. He knew, he said, that they were bound themselves to surrender. They were not relieved by the king or the prince in person. But only the fortunes of the sea had stopped them from crossing to the Poitvin's aid. He urged them to make a sortie from the walls and join forces with him to confront the French in battle. These proposals provoked agonized debate inside the citadel of Thours, where the sentiment of the Poitvins was still very much with Edward III. The Lord of Parthenay, speaking strongly for accepting Felton's proposal, and offered various reasons why it was consistent with the oaths they had sworn to the French, but no one else took this view. The herald returned to New York, bearing their excuses and a copy of their treaty with the French leaders. Felton contemplated challenging the French army, but his scouts reported there were more than 3,000 French troops drawn up in battle order on the plain south of Thours, and their banners were unfurled. His men refused to continue against such odds, and he was forced to withdraw. On December 1, 1372, the Poitevins came out of the gates of Thours unarmed and rode into the French camp. Later that day, the Franciscan church at Loudun, they did homage to the Duke of Berry as the Count of Poitiers. On December the 11th, the three royal dukes and constable entered Paris, accompanied by the leading barons of Poitou, bringing the prisoners of Sorbois in their train. Then the following day, a magnificent ceremony in the Great Hall of the Louvre took place. Duke de Berry did homage for Poitou to his brother, the king. The Poitevins, for their part, swore oaths of loyalty to the crown, promising to uphold its rights against all persons, especially the King of England and his children. Now, the surrender at Thours left the English with just 5 places of any military value in Poitou: La Roche-sur-Yon, Montagne-Sèvres, Vendée, Lucan, Guesclin south of Poitiers, and the walled town of New York in the west. Felton left Sir John Devereux in command of these places when he returned to Bordeaux in December. Combined strength of their garrison seems to have been between 1,000 and 1,200 men. Devereux did what he could to hang on to those enclaves. He established his headquarters at New York and maintained a spirited guerrilla warfare for another 4 months, but he was in an impossible position. The hostility of the inhabitants made the place difficult to defend. Scattered distribution of his forces made it equally difficult to fight in the field. In February of 1373, Bertrand de Guesclin returned to the province with an army largely composed of Breton companies and converts amongst the local nobility to mop up Devereux's garrisons. Olivier de Clisson laid siege to Montagne-sur-Serre and La Roche-sur-Yon. The French seneschal of Poitou laid siege to Lucan. The constable himself prowled about New York with a field force of some 500 men. So as you can see, the English position is just hanging on by a thread. So we'll continue to see what happens as we go further along. Now the sources for this: The Chronicles by Froissart, The 100 Years War by Perrois, The 100 Years War by Nylands, The 100 Years War, A House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.